Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. We have quite a bit to look forward to in Season 4. The next 10 episodes will feature some old regulars, but also some new blood that I'm really excited about. Linda Antonsson will be back, but I'll also feature an interview with Elio Garcia. You'll remember that Linda and Elio are Martin's co-authors on The World of Ice and Fire. I'll also include a couple new medievalists. So Oxford's Caroline Larrington will be back. I'm excited to have her back. But I will also bring in a professor of medieval philosophy and a medievalist who specializes in medieval warfare. So we'll have that to look forward to. On this week's episode, Chad and I will be talking about the first and really only Clegane Bowl. This is when the Hound and the Mountain exchange blows, and for some reason, the Hound can't quite seal the deal. So then Chad and I argue over why the Hound isn't going for the head. Steve and I talked about cannibalism and the new actor for the non-goofy Dario. Steve has some pretty strong opinions on this. And in my bird's eye view, we dip into medieval history and learn about King Leon, who is so fat he's deposed of the throne for obesity, and in an effort to get his throne back, has his mouth sewn shut. So this week, lots of stuff about eating and overeating and trying not to eat. Things that I've thought about far too often because of my COVID-enhanced dad bod. Without further ado, here is Professor Chad Carmichael. Chad, you're not a show aficionado. You're sort of a book-only guy.
I'm a book guy.
So here's a question I've never asked you before.
Okay.
When you're reading the book, do you see Sean Bean when you think of Ned Stark?
Yeah, I think I do.
Just because of all of that cover art imagery?
I don't exactly know why. I mean, I have watched a few episodes of the show, so I think that those
left
a big mark for me.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So is Tyrion Dinklage?
He is, but I feel kind of, I've occasionally felt that was unfortunate because although, you know, everybody really likes him, that actor, and he seems to have done a great job. I think you've pointed this out a few times. I really think he's handsomer than Tyrion is supposed to be in the books. And so I kind of wish I could have a more authentic experience of the book where I had my own way of thinking about Tyrion. But I think his image, his face has somehow dominated my imagination.
I recently interviewed Greg Webster, who's always good for like some crazy theories and whatnot.
Yeah.
And one of the things that he brought up was that he thinks that Tyrion was twins. And then in utero, the eggs fused. And so that explains two different hair colors, two different eye colors, and, you know, his condition in some way. And if that's the case, then, you know, not having him have two different eye colors at least is a huge plot omission for the show. Yeah. That will be different in the book.
Right.
Although I don't know how far to take Greg's theories, but man, they're fun.
Right. Do you think that a lot of theories will play out in the books that were not represented at all in the show?
Well, I mean, there's certain things that are like let me give you a good example of this. So Cersei goes to this woods witch, and the woods witch makes this prophecy about Cersei's ultimate demise, and the Woods Witch says in the books that she'll be killed by the Valonqar, which is means younger brother. That's not in the show. They don't do that in the show. They have her go to a Woods Witch, but she never says she's going to be killed by a younger brother. But that got a lot of show watchers really hot and bothered about how is Cersei going to die? Who's going to kill her? Is it going to be Tyrion? Is it going to be Jaime? Is it going to be someone else that is someone else's younger brother?
How does she die in the show?
Well, she is trying to flee the crumbling city with Jaime, and they both get crushed by the stones of the castle.
Oh, really?
And they do a little homage to the Valonqar, like when Tyrion unearths the corpse of Jaime and Cersei, his hand is kind of placed at her neck.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And so there's like this little wink to like, because a lot of fans were just spinning their wheels over like, right. Who's going to, how it has to be the Valonqar. And then there were a few of us that were saying, yeah, but that's in the book. That's not in the show.
Yeah.
So I do think that there are little things like that, that the show just decided to omit for lots of reasons. Some reasons make more sense than others.
Yeah.
But it's interesting to me that you're affected by the same sort of show contamination that the rest of us are when you're reading this.
To some degree, yeah.
Just as visually speaking.
Sure. Like, I don't think I really know what the actor who plays, what's the guy, the Onion Knight, what's that guy's name?
Davos.
Yeah, I don't think I know what the actor who plays that guy looks like. So that he's mine in my imagination.
Oh, sure.
You know, Stannis, I don't think I have an actor associated with
him. Right, because that's all season two stuff.
Yeah, so I just watched a few episodes, you know, and decided I didn't want to watch anymore. But
Right. Chad, I'm going to read a synopsis of this chapter. Ned and Barristan Selmy reflect on the short life of Hugh of the Vale, who is now only a corpse. The two men confront Robert about his plan to fight in the Hand's Tourney melee. Robert concedes and laments his plight as king, laments his lying son, laments his cold wife, and then smells bacon. Ned and Robert laugh over old times at breakfast. Then Ned sits with Sansa at the tilts. After an incident between the Knight of Flowers and the Mountain, the Clegane brothers cross swords. After an archery contest, Ned is visited by a costumed Varys who warns him that Robert's life is in danger, and then he implies that Ned's life is also in danger. So, Chad Carmichael, yes. Would you like to talk about a plot point, a theme, or a character?
I think I'll climb the ladder of chaos.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that's what I'm choosing.
You had forsaken it for so many times, I didn't even offer it.
Right. Yeah, this is a chaos time, I'm afraid.
All right, so, okay, chaos time. Do you want to start or do you want me to start?
I'll start. I just want to start by saying that Gregor Clegane is a contemptible person. And I know everybody knows that already, but he's just especially in fine form in this chapter.
Well, he's a serial killer. And we've talked about the problem of serial killers before. And of course, Ned is not concerned with Gregor, who's a serial killer. Because Ned turns a blind eye to serial killers. But Gregor probably killed his dad, killed two of his wives, killed several animals and several servants. I mean, the guy is just, he's not just contemptible. He's a murderous monster.
A monster, that's right. And I feel like it's misleading to call him a serial killer. I don't feel like that's quite... Right. I mean, we have all these associations of serial killers.
How many murders does it take to become a serial killer?
Well, he's murdered a lot of people and he enjoys murdering people. But I just, you know, he doesn't have the kind of psychological complexity or something that you expect in a serial killer. Right. He just seems like a brutish monster.
Yeah, I think that we're maybe splitting hairs here.
Oh yeah, that's what I'm definitely splitting hairs. That's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, I think you're being a nincompoop, Chad. If he lived in our world, he would have to be sneaky and devise little plans to stalk people, but he doesn't. He lives in his world. He runs a castle basically. And Tywin lets him do whatever he wants, and so he can get away with murder. And so he does it many times.
I think it's
making
interesting.
Making him a serial killer.
Yeah, I think it's interesting and telling that he almost never talks. He probably says a few words, but...
You're right. He doesn't have a lot of speaking. He is...
He's a monster.
He's like a monster.
It's really... I mean, this is already a very dark world that Martin has created. And to create a villain who's so dark... Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's a real achievement, I think. I thought it was funny when Ned told Robert that he was too fat for his armor.
Well, Ned, all right. Part of Ned's appeal to Robert is that he can say things like that.
Yeah.
And he's not sniveling around like Lancel Lannister. That, and everyone else is kind of, you know, being coy or telling him half truths or trying to, you know, massage the, you know, their agenda. Where Ned, the reason why I think Robert likes Ned is that Ned is always Ned. And he's going to just say it the way he thinks it's, you know, it should be said. And there's something about that that attracts Robert. Like Ned looks like a man ought to look and talks the way a man ought to talk. He's not
Right.
he's not slinking around in costumes. He's a man's man.
Yeah.
And so I think that that probably serves Ned really well in this chapter, but we know that eventually it's gonna really get Ned in trouble.
Right. But not with Robert.
Well, we'll see how that goes. We'll see how that
Yeah.
goes.
Yeah.
We're not quite there yet. Did Robert plan to use his Warhammer in the melee?
Think so. Yeah.
That's some bullshit.
You think it's not fair that he has a hammer or something?
Everyone else has these blunted swords. And so at the end of the melee, what happens? You know, they have some bruises, a clavicle got broken.
Yeah.
People, you know, I guess Thoros gets to light his sword on fire, which is probably isn't fair either. But Robert Baratheon in there with a Warhammer, how do you blunt a Warhammer?
That's a good point. I
He's
didn't really think
gonna
about it.
smash skulls in there. No one else is gonna have a weapon that can get him.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I mean, it really fits nicely with the point that Ned and Selmy make to him, where they say, look, nobody's gonna come at you really, because you're the king. And I thought it was funny about that too, that he immediately proves them right by threatening Selmy. Right? He's like so mad about it that he throws something at Selmy and like tells him to get out before he kills him. And
Right.
it's like, well, that's exactly right. That's exactly what right, Robert, because I said something you didn't like. Now you may kill me.
Right.
And that's exactly how everybody on the field is going to reason when they think about hitting you.
Right. Okay. So, sure. I mean that's part of it. Part of it is that, you know, you don't want to be the guy that killed the king.
Yeah.
Or you don't want to be the guy that, you know, that made the king angry enough to want to kill you or whatever. My point is that Warhammer should be disallowed in the melee.
Yeah, I think you're right.
That just seems it's unfair. It's not
Do we
like
have conclusive evidence that he was going to use the hammer? I think I remember it saying that his hammer
it was like on display or whatever.
was on
We don't
display.
know for sure what he was gonna do, but if he was going to, like I asked you, like, do you think he was going to use his Warhammer? And you just assumed yes.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I assumed too. I mean, we never hear of him using a sword.
Right.
Not to say that he couldn't use a sword. I'm just saying, whatever his intentions were, I'm going to propose a new rule to the melee: no lighting
Yeah.
swords on fire, no Warhammers.
No Warhammers. What if you could get like a half-weight Warhammer? Would a half-weight Warhammer be okay?
Yeah, if you could promise me that it wasn't going to crush armor,
Yeah.
then I'd be like, all right, I'll consider it. Like aluminum. Like something that'll give someone a good, you know, ring someone's bell, maybe. But like, armor is ineffectual in this case.
The mountain killed this young man who used to be a squire, right?
Hue of the Veil, yes.
That's right, Hugh. That's right.
Yeah.
We think he killed that guy. And I mean, the suggestion is that the mountain received an order from,
Yeah.
like, I guess Tywin, or
Whoever's behind, see, that's the question.
I just think it's funny to imagine the conversation where some Lannister tries to tell Gregor what to do.
Well, all right, but we know that it happens. We know that
I guess so.
Tywin does tell the mountain what to do.
It's just hard to imagine somebody exerting control over the guy. He seems like a, it seems a little bit like trying to exert control over a bear.
He's a little bit like Darth Vader.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, there are people that outrank Darth Vader, but yeah. Darth Vader kind of goes along with it. Right. Maybe because he's got some other goal in mind or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, don't take it too far.
Yeah.
Don't take it too far.
All right. So interesting development. Robert admits that he knew that his son was lying about the wolf.
Yeah. So Robert is not, I mean, he's foolish for sure, right?
He is. I can't help but really love Robert. I know that you're not supposed to or something, but I just find him lovable, even though he's such a fool.
I find this very strange. It's a very strange approach to Robert.
He's a man who's dominated by his appetites. And I just feel like in another situation, he would have been a better man than he is.
Well, he says he wants to go across the narrow sea and become the king who became a hedge knight or something like that.
See, he would be better. He would be a better person if he did that.
I don't know if he'd be better. He's still the kind of person who is so tired and frustrated that he allows his best friend's daughter's pet to be beheaded or something, or he calls for the pelt or something.
Yeah.
That's unforgivable.
I don't know.
If you were to be responsible for mm-hmm. my daughter's dog's death, we would have words.
But if we lived in this world and it went,
oh, I would pull off my glove and slap thee across thy face.
Yeah.
If that were to happen.
See, this is the continual problem with this story is that everybody's really has crossed moral lines that are just unacceptable. From our perspective as, you know, people in our world. And yet it's an interesting story and you want to follow along and you find yourself caring about and identifying with some of these characters. And you're constantly reminded, oh my gosh, this person's a terrible person, but I'm sitting here just sort of rooting for them or something. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the negative things in a way about these books, but it's a struggle as a reader, I think.
So Hugh killed John Arryn, or at least he was the, you know, he was the device used to kill John Arryn, right?
Yeah.
Oh, at least this is what Varys says. Varys claims.
He was close to John Arryn. Like it's very dark that he was the killer.
Yeah, but there was, Varys suggested that he became very prosperous. Mm-hmm. Like John Arryn's retinue, his family and whatnot, retired to the Vale, but Hugh stayed behind and became very prosperous, according to Varys.
Right.
So he's in someone else's pocket.
Right. Yeah. But it's just very sad because you imagine that Hugh was trusted by John.
Perhaps. I mean, yeah. I mean, look, we don't know a lot about John Arryn's personality except for through the sort of the tinted memories of Robert and Ned, right? Mm-hmm. He's his father figure. We do know that he didn't like the idea of Robert killing Daenerys when mm-hmm. she was a child. You do get the sense that he seems to be a man of high character from one point of view.
Yeah.
On the other hand, he allows Robert to beggar the realm. He suggests that Robert should marry Tywin's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
So you could look at John Arryn in a different way and think, well, he was foolish too in that he basically allowed Tywin to step in and become this really major political force in the kingdom.
Right.
And couldn't even rein in Robert's spending when it started to be a real big problem. So I don't know about John Arryn's legacy. I don't know if he also was a fool.
Maybe he was a little like Ned, just not.
Maybe he was a little like Ned. That's right. So Hugh poisoned John.
Yeah.
So then the question is, who is behind Hugh? And I think that Varys drops his first little clue at the very end of this chapter about who is behind Hugh.
Oh, yeah? What did he say?
Well, it's one of these, you know how Martin will do these three-stage reveals where he'll like just leave a little morsel of a breadcrumb, and then a really astute reader will see and start developing a theory, and then he'll follow it up with a confirmation that's understated.
Right.
And then later on, he'll like, for all of the rest of us dummies who didn't see it the first time, he'll like hit you over the head with a 2x4 saying it was Lysa Aaron who did it.
Right. Right.
So this is called, I think that the breadcrumb here is that he was killed with the tears of lice.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's spelled in the same way that Lysa spells her name.
Right.
And I don't think it's meant to be like in world, I don't think that the poison's named after her. She's named after the poison. I just think that this is a literary clue.
Sure.
For, you know, it kind of in some way tickles Martin. Like, right. Like, look, I told you on page 200 who it was, you know.
Sure.
If you had eyes to see it. So I do think that he drops this little this first little clue in this chapter.
Yeah, that's good. I missed that this time.
Well, I missed it. I missed it a lot of times, and I mean, part of me thinks it probably wasn't just Lysa.
Yeah,
you know, I don't think Lysa is the kind of person who would do that of her own volition.
All right, I got a question for you.
Yeah.
So, after the joust with Loris and the mountain. And the mountain's about to come kill Loris, right?
Yeah.
The hound steps in to protect him and fights Gregor.
The Clegane Bowl. Yep.
That's right. And it says, thrice Ned saw Sir Gregor aim savage blows at the hound's head helmet, yet not once did Sandor send a cut at his brother's unprotected face.
Yeah.
I just wasn't sure how to interpret that. Did that have any meaning?
I paused there too. And the only thing that I could come up with is that from Ned's vantage point, the hound is fighting more honorably.
Yeah.
He's thinking, I mean, I don't know if this is true. It could be that the hound just doesn't want to kill his big brother yet, you know? But I think from Ned's perspective, he's noticing, oh, this guy knows he's fighting an opponent who's not wearing headgear.
Yeah.
And so he's not fighting to murder him.
Right.
Because if he was, he'd be going for the head.
Sure.
How did you take that?
The hound hates him, right? We know that the hound hates the mountain.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I hate Donald Trump, but I probably wouldn't kill him.
You're not the hound. Let's remind ourselves that the hound murdered a child just a few, you know, half a book ago. So
for the record, I would not kill Donald Trump. I just want to make that clear.
No, I know you're a gentle soul.
The hound is willing to murder. And he can brag about it to Sansa and saying, actually, I kind of like it.
Yeah.
And your daddy probably likes it, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So you're right. It very well could be that he's not ready to. It's his big brother. Like he hates his big brother. And yet. There's probably cultural taboos about kinslaying, but there's probably also like. Psychological, you know, am I ready to kill?
No way. That doesn't sound right to me. Here's my theory.
What?
He's just scared of the Lannisters.
What?
He thinks if he kills his the mountain, that the Lannisters, who plainly enough have the guy's leash, would be unhappy with him.
No one would fault him. It's probably thousands of eyes on him right now. Clearly, yeah. The mountain was about to do something dishonorable. He's defending the Knight of Flowers, who everyone loves.
Yeah.
If he were to take off the mountain's head, no one could fault him for doing that.
Not even the Lannisters, huh?
I mean, if they would probably promote him. They're like, well, we don't have the mountain anymore. Sandor, How about taking over and being our lead henchman?
Yeah.
I don't think that they have any affection for the mountain. They just
right, second tier. Maybe he was afraid
of a mad dog or whatever.
Maybe he was still trying to win the tournament, and he felt like if he killed Gregor, he wouldn't get selected as the winner.
I think my solution's better. There's this thing about your brother that even if you hate him, you're not just gonna kill him as if he's some stranger on the street.
I think when your brother is a complete monster who just who burned your face and murdered your father and just hacked the head off of a horse, I think it's a different situation. I'm sorry.
I think we're both just gonna have to plead ignorance on this one.
It's a mysterious thing, right? Okay, here's what I really think. None of the theories we've just offered are very good explanation of him not trying to hurt Gregor worse.
Mm.
So it's a mystery.
Well, we know in this world that kinslaying is a taboo, right?
You just said that no one would blame him if he did it.
Yeah, but he would blame himself.
That does not sound like the Hound. I don't picture the Hound like going back to his quarters and sitting down and just thinking, oh man, what have I done? I feel so bad about it. Like, that's just not his.
No, but I'm saying that when you're in the throes, do you ever watch Throw Mama from the Train?
I'm sure I did, but it's
this guy hates his mother and he wants her dead. But when it comes right down to it,
just can't do it.
He just can't kill his own mother. That just doesn't, it's just, there's yeah. something unnatural.
You're just going to stick to this sort of theory that you've got. Okay. All right.
It's Let's the only on. Thing that either of us has said that makes any sense.
I think the theory that he's worried about crossing powerful people is a better theory, but.
All right.
I got another question.
Okay.
Why did Ned trust Varys in this chapter?
Varys is making a lot of sense, I think.
That's exactly what you would expect Varys to do, is make a lot of sense and be untrustworthy, right? I mean, I just thought Ned was so dumb in this interaction. Yeah. He was given really no evidence. Varys told him something that made sense to him. So he's like, you know what? I think you're just right about everything, because what you just said made a lot of sense.
Ned has been spinning his wheels.
Yeah.
Ned's mind is like this little hamster wheel that just keeps like spinning over the same data over and over and over. Mm-hmm. And finally, Varys comes in with some very interesting additional data that is like, oh, this guy's connecting dots that I hadn't thought about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to milk him for information here.
Right.
I'm going to clearly this guy is better at this than I am. I should at least ask him.
Yeah.
Who killed John Arryn?
Right.
And he does, and he gets an answer that it seems very plausible, and he doesn't have a plausible answer yet.
Yeah.
I'll be honest, I've been rereading these last few chapters in this sort of the 30s chapters.
Yeah.
And I keep puzzling over Varys's motives. I keep thinking, like, what is he doing? Like, what's his... He's clearly creating impressions. It's like he's toying with Pycelle at one point. He seems to be helping Ned, and yet, and maybe trying to keep Ned alive, but I don't know. It's really hard to guess at what Varys is up to.
I think Varys is supposed to be mysterious to the maximum, and he is, and it's impossible. I think it's an impossible mystery.
Hmm.
He's too clever for us to be able to tell.
Some notable introductions, Chad.
Mm-hmm.
Tears of Lice introduced. We meet Lancel Lannister for the first time. And although she's not named, I do think we hear the first mention of Maya Stone. Do you remember who Maya Stone is?
Yes.
She is a bastard daughter, because her last name is Stone, of the Vale.
Right. Oh, right. Okay.
And we'll meet her up at the Vale in this book. But she's about the same age as Robert's first child.
Right.
So I think that she's mentioned, not by name, but she's mentioned in a roundabout way as Robert's first, you know, out of wedlock progeny. Book differences, show differences. One major difference in the show, Barristan doesn't go in the tent to try to convince Robert not to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And they give one of Barristan's key lines to Ned. So Ned says, they're not going to hit you. You're the king. So you're going to win. And that is the thing that convinces Robert not to fight.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's the exact right thing to say to him. But in the book, it's Barristan that knows the way to get to Robert's ego.
Yeah.
Ned is not smart enough to know that in the book. He kind of recognizes, oh, Barristan is going about this a much better way than I would have ever thought of.
Yeah.
It really does raise my opinion of Barristan in a way that I hadn't before. In fact, the first time I read this, I just assumed that that was Ned's line. And then the second time I read this chapter, I realized, oh, that's not Ned. I was sort of projecting my show memory onto the book.
I think you're being a little too hard on Ned here.
Well, if I am, then I will accept. I mean, I'm often trying to keep people from being too hard on Ned.
Yeah, look, I just, here's what I want to observe. It's really disappointing and maybe even bad for a friendship when you have to treat a close friend. You have to manipulate a close friend in that way instead of just being straight with him. You know? And so he's trying to be Robert's friend. He's trying to speak plainly to him instead of manipulating him. And everybody always manipulates Robert, right?
What does Varys say at the end of this chapter? He says, if I would have come to you and told you that Robert was going to be killed in the melee, you would have run to Robert and Robert would have taken it as a challenge.
Yeah.
And he would have said, well, I'm going to fight just to prove that they can't kill me in that way.
Right.
And so I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that Varys has that kind of sense. He knows that Robert's ego rules the day.
You think Robert could have pulled it off?
I think Robert might have died. Because when's the last time he actually swung that hammer? I don't feel like he's the kind of guy who goes out and is like training. I feel like he trains by going to war, and there hasn't been a war in 14 years.
Right.
He might be really fat and slow, and if you're trying to swing around a big old hammer like that,
But it would have been kind of sweet if Robert went out there and they tried to kill him and they couldn't, right?
It would have been, you know, it would have been badass for sure. That's right. It would have been badass, but I'm wondering whether he's too fat and slow to actually be effectual with a Warhammer at this point.
By the way, when I think of Robert, I don't remember what the actor looks like. I think of a 1980s metal rock star. and old Robert, I think of a fattened version of that.
You know what you should be thinking of? Do you remember Fight Club?
Yeah.
Do you remember the character that Meatloaf plays in Fight Club?
Yeah.
That's Robert Bradley.
Yeah, I can see that.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV+, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Steve?
Yes, sir?
If I gave you my permission, and I was already dead, and it was the only way that you could survive, would you eat my arm?
When did you give me the permission? Is this thing written down, or is it like, as you're dying?
All right, let's say we're both on a desert island, and the seagulls are all dead, and I've just been impaled. And as I'm dying, with my last breath, I say, Steve,
eat my arm.
Eat my arm.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You would do it.
Sure.
All right. So you get along with the Thins.
So this is a this is a Heather moment that I love. We got cannibals now.
Well, I mean, come on. We've seen Ramsay at work. Is this really going to be? I love this show because it's, in some ways, it's able to kind of grab some really old taboos that are so taboo that most people, it never even occurs to them to think about, right? So twincest or whatever. Really old taboo, really old taboo. Like for a long time, this has been a taboo.
Yeah, it's like back in the 50s.
Or, you know, things like, can you really trust a bastard? I mean, this is old school stuff.
Right.
This show is able to kind of take things like cannibalism.
This particular episode talked about having sex with goats, like I think a couple times.
That's right. Yeah. Really, really old taboos. So, although, you know, I guess it depends on your culture.
You're going to advocate here.
I'm open-minded. You know, you get 1,000 years of a culture reinforcing don't eat other people. It's going to, you know, there's going to be something deep-seated in the core of your conscious.
At the very least, you're going to be afraid, is this person just hanging out with me because they think I'm delish?
Some of us are more delicious than others, Steve. So this season that's coming up is going to be a super, super expensive season, and it could just be the CGI.
Bigger dragons. You
know, we got bigger dragons. Clearly, they're more of a problem, right?
Right.
But bigger, you know, bigger events, maybe bigger battle scenes or whatever. Clearly we have some kind of convergence at the wall that's probably going to be a spectacle.
I mean, if we're going to be bringing in potential for White Walkers, I mean, that's between CGI and makeup. That's a lot. So we're just totally different Dario.
Totally different Dario.
To the point where I'm like, who is this character and why should I know who he is? So I had to stop watching and look it up.
And they even like said his name like 3 times just to kind of say, hey, by the way, this is what we're doing now.
Look, man, like you said, they're already starting to diverge from the books. Pull a Jack and Hagar face shift or something. Do whatever you want.
Right.
Have her say, your face displeases me, like off screen. And it comes, do you like this one? And I'm like, all right, fine. I guess he's that guy now. don't just come at me with, you know, oh, yeah, you know that goofball that we just saw? Now he's just a regular dude. Like, make this guy goofy. Maybe still, like, give him the same hair.
So here's where they went wrong, Steve. I'm going to read you what Dario is supposed to look like. I'm getting this from the wiki, all right? Dario is lithe and smooth-skinned.
Okay.
With bright, deep blue eyes, which can appear almost purple. His curly hair reaches his collar, and he keeps his beard cut in 3 prongs. Dario dyes his hair and trident beard, sometimes blue, other times deep purple, sometimes a different color on either side. His fingernails are also enameled blue. Dario's mustachios are painted gold. He has a large, curvy nose. And a golden tooth gleams in his mouth.
So I feel like the guy from Warrant that was the last Dario, while not following all of those criteria, at least captured the spirit, right?
See, here's the thing. If they would have followed this description, it almost doesn't matter who the actor is.
Right. You would have known by looking at the purple haired guy with the gold tooth and go, oh, okay, yes, that's Dario.
Exactly. But you could have brought in some other like guy that kind of looked like Dario and put all the makeup on him, and you would have never known it was a different character.
Right. It's just like when in RoboCop 3 when they just made the face look like Peter Weller's.
Okay, now let me ask you this. As described, what does that tell us about Danny's taste in men?
Yeah, she's a freak. But so this is an issue that I had. Like, I mean, okay, you've already made the decision in the previous season to not follow all of those attributes. That's fine. You know, it's your world. But then this guy is like, this guy could be anybody in this saga, right? I mean, there's at least a dozen dudes that look like Dario looks like right now, right? To me, he doesn't stand out at all. Like, there's nothing about him that's like, it's that guy. So now he's just a rugged white dude in a series with plenty of rugged white dudes.
We are rotten with the rugged
we
white
dudes. We are just, yeah. In fact, if this show is just called Game of Rugged White Dudes, no one would know any difference.
So I guess the old Dario like got some sort of movie deal. He was like on some sort of transporter.
He said it was more political, his leaving, than it was.
Oh,
yeah, I started reading this stuff because I'm just like, because I'll be honest, like, you know, he's a goofball, but I'm like, but I got it, right? And like his looks, his whole everything worked in terms of like me being like, what's this? What are you all about, Danny? What do you think? And then this guy, and I'm like, wait, this is the guy? He's just a dude.
All right. So I think that we're on the same page. Neither of us like this. However, I will say this. The show tends to choose pretty great actors, right? And I kind of like the idea that they just thought, if we think that that guy's a better actor than the other guy, I kind of don't care if he looks like the other guy. I'm just going to choose the best actor for the role. I don't even care if like one is like a blonde and one's a brunette. I just don't care. Just give me the best actor.
You couldn't throw a wig on him?
That's true.
I mean, how hard would that be?
That's true. Maybe there was some kind of feedback from the audience. Maybe a lot of people thought he was a goofball. I don't know what they did.
The great goofball contract. That was the politics that he was talking about. I can't help it if I'm a goofball. It's just the way God made me.
I want to know if this new actor can whistle, because he's got to pull off a pretty mean whistle for me to buy it. All right, so I want to talk about Cersei and Jaime.
Yeah, man. We talked about the possibility, you know, that they're different now.
Well, they're certainly different now, but I kind of get the sense from this episode that Jaime was always more into Cersei than Cersei was into Jaime.
Yeah, but I think you alluded to that last time, right? Like, I mean, we're talking about her with
yeah, he was with Lancel. She was with Lancel.
Yeah, so, and he's been like, so this was kind of his whole thing. This is the confirmation that his motivation to get back was almost exclusively for Cersei. So even if he's changed his mind or he's had some complicated feelings along the way, it's still this sense of like, yeah, but I was pot committed to this. So I'm still kind of hoping that this will work out, even if it's misguided. Right.
That's right.
So, but for Cersei, it was just kind of like, I mean, she's the real sociopath, right? I mean, if you're going to create a scale.
And it could be taught. I mean, this could be a taught thing. Like, you're raised by Tywin Lannister, and then you are, you know, you basically from the time you're 16 to, you know, you're 40 or whatever, you are playing the games of King's Landing. And you get the sense that she's just a survivor. She's going to look up for herself.
Well, and while Jamie's been gone, she's been charting a different path. She's had to negotiate a lot of different things, and she's had to make her way, and she's, you know, good or bad or easy or not. I don't, Jamie's one of these things. It's like, well, now I have to navigate this again.
And she says something like, you're too late.
Yeah.
You were too late.
Took too long.
And it was kind of like, does that mean it's sort of like, all right, I'm over you? Or does it mean like, you could have helped me in a number of ways, and I realize I'm self-sufficient, I don't need you, or yeah. something like
that. Yeah, so there's a lot there, right? It could be like, yeah, I'm, like, you could read it initially like almost a certain petulance, like, well, I wanted you here sooner, and you're not, so now I'm mad at you. But there's more to it than that, I think, what you just laid out, is this idea of like, yeah, I mean, you gave me enough time to get over either needing you or whatever. I don't, like, now I gotta, on top of it, what are you now? You're maimed. You're not gonna take over what, Casterly Rock. Who are you? And what, I gotta deal with this drama now too.
There's also the age thing. And this is a lot of people have this problem where the thing that attracts you to someone when you're young is not the thing that attracts you to them when you're older. Mm-hmm. Especially with men that won't grow up. It's like, you were exciting when you were young, and I kind of like the spontaneity, and I kind of like that I was with Peter Pan when we were both 20. Now that we're in our 40s, dude, grow up, man.
Right. And also, if you had been here all the time, I might not have noticed this.
She also kind of puts it on him, like, you're the one that chased Ned Stark out of the city. Like, you didn't have to leave.
Right.
Like, basically, you know, you attacked Ned Stark of your own volition. It started this combination of tumblers in motion, and it ended up with you in prison. And so you brought that on yourself. I do think there's a little bit of sociopath there. I guess I'm trying to look at it from her point of view at the same time, but it's hard to.
Well, especially with what she says, and the thing about Cersei is, unlike some of these other characters, you don't necessarily need to read between the lines with her.
Yeah, she wears it on her sleeve, right?
She's pretty clear, you know, and her motives are her motives, and she holds on to them pretty pretty unabashedly.
Cersei and Qyburn are striking up a little relationship. That's interesting. Yeah. You don't hear Cersei praise too many people, but she likes the mad scientist.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of an interesting twist.
Arya and the Hound.
Yeah, man. Talk about a subplot I'm all in for.
They could just do everything on Arya and the Hound. They could do a whole season with Arya and the Hound. I'd be all in on
these
that.
Two. I mean, just in terms of the way that they work together and what it does for the narrative.
Arya, she is a stone cold killer.
Yep. She's not just flirting with it anymore.
No, she's doing it. And if there was any other, there's any question about it. And it's almost like she thinks, like, is she out over her skis, or does she think, oh, he's going to back me up?
That's a great question, right? And I interpreted it as, look, man, I don't really have all that much to live for. Right. I'm looking to get revenge. That's what's keeping me alive. So if it kills me, that's fine too.
I mean, talk about the Terminator. Now she's the Terminator. Right. She's sort of like, she's got these kill commands in her vision. And if she thinks, oh, I can get vengeance right now, I don't even care if I die doing it.
Right. So if you look at the Deadpool, there's, you know, she wants these certain people dead, but it's like, from a logical standpoint, it's like, what are the odds I can make it through all of them and then still get to Joffrey? Right. I mean, that's like, that's a tall order. So I'm gonna start clipping off what I can clip off.
And I think she really wants that sword back.
That was clear. That was clear because it means a couple of things, right? I mean, getting it back means that she was able to get it back from that who took it. It's her sword, you know. It's
her sword, and it was given to her when her family was still intact.
Yeah.
Right. And so it reminds her of John. It reminds her of Ned. It reminds her of, you know.
If you're romantic at all, to do anything to your Deadpool list with that particular sword, that's
right.
That's poetic, right?
she's kind of sick of sitting on, you know, next to him.
Yeah. Oh man, that scene when she's got her own horse is just fantastic.
Yeah, fantastic. And just get the sense that these two, like, whatever age difference there is there, like we noted the age, like the pronounced age difference between Tyrion and Sansa.
Mm-hmm.
But these two, just as sort of comrades on the road, they're really not that different. You know, they've both seen some things. They both had a sort of a traumatic childhood experience. They've got a lot that unites them. And they don't care if they eat every chicken in the room, man.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
I love the scene where you realize, okay, the Hound is actually going to turn on this guy. Because there was a little bit there where the Hound was just like, look, let's just get through this. I'm hungry. I'm thirsty.
Right.
And then, like, Polliver just flips a switch. And the Hound thinks, yeah, I guess I'm going to have to prove that I'm the biggest badass in the room.
Right.
And Arya's face just lights up.
Yeah.
All right. So we're introduced to Oberyn Martell.
Yeah. And boy, are we.
Prince Martell. And he's also called the Red Viper.
Okay.
Like, I guess these people in Dorne, they're known for using a lot of poison, like poisoning their blades, and part of it is that it kind of, it's like, hey, snakes are our thing. We're really into snakes. And so they call this guy the Red Viper.
Okay.
Now you're a snake guy, right, Steve?
Yeah. I mean, there's
Have you ever taken a snake's poison and put it on a blade?
No.
Have you ever thought about it?
No, because I like snakes, but I will not mess with a poisonous snake. I don't even want to be around. I won't be in the same room with them.
Really?
Yeah.
So you're okay with a ball snake?
Sure. Yeah.
But if there's any suggestion of poison, you're not even in the room.
No. This is something because it is interesting how that works out because. I don't know that I think Heather tends to be a little bit more like, yeah, I mean, she doesn't want one or anything, but I mean, I think she could handle it probably better than I could. I remember going to the Sebastopol pet store back when it was across from Supreme Burger.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a big old rattlesnake in like this glass terrarium.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fascinating, but man, I hated going in there. Like I'd go in there and I'd look at it because I was like, wow, that's a rattlesnake. I've never seen one. But then it was like, that shouldn't be here. It shouldn't be here. I shouldn't be here. And so, and again, my memory of it, I was probably like 3 or 4, I think, when I went in there. But so my memory of it is just huge. But I think it's because of just the how ominous it was and I could not understand. I'm like, well, why would somebody want that? Why would you want that in your house?
I had an experience that I've never had before with a wolf at a zoo.
Okay.
I'm not a big zoo fan. I don't like zoos.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat.
But I was at this zoo because it was like central Illinois and there was nothing to do. And we were like, well, there's a zoo you could go to. And I went to this zoo. And I've been in zoos where there was like a panther or, you know, a lion or a tiger or something on the other side of bars.
Right.
And I was fine. Like, I know that beast would kill me if it had a chance.
Sure.
But I went to the zoo and they had this plexiglass wall and these wolves on the other side of the wall. And these wolves were just kind of walking around looking at me. I freaked out.
Oh, wow.
Just being that close to a wolf, and it's sort of like the plexiglass didn't give any kind of visual. Like, I knew it was there.
Right.
But it was kind of like being at the top of a really tall building and, like, standing right next to the glass, and you still feel a little bit woozy.
Yeah.
I had that experience with wolves, man.
Yeah, I don't know that I've ever actually seen a wolf, now that I think about it.
Well, I don't recommend it.
Okay, well, I mean, that's fair.
So this guy, Oberyn, in the books... It may be hinted at that he's bisexual. Like, there are a couple little hints dropped. But again, HBO is going to play up the sex stuff.
Sure.
And that becomes sort of almost essential to his character.
Right.
Right. He's very open-minded. You get the sense that he's not impressed with your social status.
Right.
Like he's happy to just parade around his paramour and.
Yeah. And he's all about just sort of, he's a little bit of this, I don't care about what you guys think. I don't even care about the fact that this is Lannister country. I don't care.
I think it's kind of an amazing feat to bring in someone who is as interesting and menacing as he is at this stage in the game.
Right.
Because you almost get the sense like, oh, shit, Tywin's in trouble.
Yeah, it is interesting because there is a sense of like, I had a conversation not too long ago about playing poker. And I consider myself decent, especially like in a hold'em type situation. I understand like what should happen. And when mm-hmm. you're playing against somebody who doesn't care about what should happen, they're sometimes the hardest opponent.
Yeah.
Cause they're getting those cards on the river that like, well, nobody would wait for that.
Someone with no strategy is harder to read than someone with a strategy.
Right. Because they're like, they can, I mean, that's, you know, just because you're playing the odds of someone, I mean, the odds are just the odds. They're not the reality. And so you've got somebody here who, like, you know, the Lannisters, and Tywin has said it very carefully about how, like, he's big picture oriented. He's not here for the whims of his children. He's got a bigger play at stake. Whereas this guy, you get the sense of being like, I'll come right in and I'll call my shot. I will look you right in the eye.
So the backstory here is that when the city was overthrown by Robert, there was a move to kill every Targaryen heir. And this is when sort of Dany and her brother get spirited away to Essos. And one of his, I guess his niece and nephew, by way of Targaryen marriage, was killed by the Hound's brother, right?
Yeah, Mountain.
And the Mountain is really sort of he's like the hitman. He's like the Luca Brasi for Tywin. And this has upset Oberyn so much so that even, you know, 15 years later, he hates the Lannisters so much that even if he's getting down in the other room in a brothel and he hears Rains of Castamere,
yeah,
he's going to get up, go to the other room, and someone's going to die.
Which is an interesting moment, right? And especially timing-wise, because Rains of Castamere is still sort of echoing in fans' minds.
Yeah, yeah, we've been taught to know what that song means.
And then to have someone come in and be like, yeah, you know what? I'd kill over that song. It almost resonates maybe with the fan at that point. It's like, yeah, man, that song doesn't mean good things.
And he's in a place, he's in King's Landing, where that song just gets played over and over and over.
Exactly.
And he's just going to be triggered and triggered and triggered, right?
It's like listening to Sheryl Crow at CVS. You know you're going to have to.
you know, going in, you're like, okay, I really need that lotion, but
I'm going to have to. Crow. I'm going to have to soak up the sun at some point here.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, We've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'd like to talk about the perceptions of plumpness in the medieval period. Here I'm borrowing from a fantastic essay for medievalist Ken Monshine. By the way, Ken will be joining me for Danny's next chapter. My conversation with Chad noted Robert's fatness. Famously, Ned tells the king that he has grown too fat for his armor. Moreover, it's clear that Ned disapproves of Robert's rotund dad bod. While I'm certainly an expert on the dad bod problem, I'm no expert on medieval conceptions of fatness, so I turned to Ken's article on medievalists.net. The article is titled Fatness and Thinness in the Middle Ages. It's a great article. It's short, worth reading for sure. One of the things that Ken emphasizes is that perceptions of the virtues and vices of volume varied. These varied according to geography, class, gender, just to name a few. I'll focus on kings and knights here because these seem most relevant to Robert's situation. He is, after all, a king who dreams of being a simple knight again. Moreover, he laments his own largeness because he desperately wants to fit into his armor to compete in the melee. This, as Stark and Selmy both observe, is a sport of knights, not kings. Thus, Robert's dad bod is a reflection on his existential dissonance. Ken explains that many folks considered knights to require an athletic build. The fit of one's armor was important as well as one's dexterity once fully armed. At the very least, knights needed to bend at the middle, something that Robert would have had trouble with, even with his breastplate in place. That said, a man within the knightly class was expected to afford lots and lots of food. The trick here was that a knight was expected to be generous with his excess. Ken also reminds us that in the tale of Sir Gawain, the titular knight, is said to have a thin waist, thus to the ideal. By the way, I looked it up. There are multiple correct ways to pronounce Gawain. So if you've just seen The Green Knight and now you're wondering how to pronounce it correctly, there are multiple views on this. But back to the matter at hand. But the Middle Ages does not speak with one voice on this matter. Some writers attempt to subvert the ideal. I think we can say generally, however, that there was an ideal to be subverted. What then about kings? In many ways, the ideals for the knightly class and the ideals for kingship overlapped. Bacon points out that some among the Carolinians of medieval France associated prodigious eating with rulership. Much like early American pop culture, being fat was often associated with wealth. Of course, this was at times a problem for kings who took their gastronomic liberties to extremes. Kant offers the example of the 10th century King Sancho of Leon, who exceeded 500 pounds. He had trouble riding, walking, and procreating. This led to him being deposed from the throne in 958. Sancho ended up seeking a weight loss treatment, so to speak, from the Sultan of Cordova. This treatment involved having his mouth sewn shut, vigorous massage, and being fed some sort of elixir of opium and herbs. This did indeed lead to his weight loss, and he was able to retake the throne 2 years later from some dude named Ordono the Wicked. 6 years after that, he was assassinated by way of poison. God, I love this stuff. And that's all for this week.